Welcome to an hour by the window at the White Network. I am August Hurst. Episode last week, I discussed how people of European descent have been detrimentally impacted by domestic and foreign policies influenced by our myths about the past. The most prominent myth has been the Good War myth of World War II, which posits a simplistic dichotomy of heroes and villains in a war presumably driven by the foreign policy goals of Adolf Hitler. I tried to point out some specific aspects of domestic and foreign policy that have been particularly harmful to us in racial terms, especially immigration reform, and post-Cold War military adventures that have not served our interest, but rather the interest of our enemies. I ended the program's second half by discussing in some detail relevant aspects of Adolf Hitler's worldview and his foreign policy goals. In sum, my argument was that we cannot escape the narrative of history or reject revisionism because it is a false perception of what has occurred before us that has led us to where we are today. The principal thesis that I advanced was that Adolf Hitler was motivated by a desire for stability with the West and an underlying desire for an alliance with the British Empire. I further discussed how this fact about Hitler's principal foreign policy worldview undercuts the claims made to justify the Anglo-French declaration of war against Germany and the extension of America's involvement after 1939 and its culmination into a de facto war in 1941 with Germany. For if Hitler did not intend to undermine the empires of the West or the position of the United States in the Americas, then what is the principal basis of the claim that Hitler represented a threat with which the West had to deal? And if this war was unnecessary from the perspective of real vital interest on the part of the West and broadly construed our racial interest, what impact does this fact have on many of the assumptions that have driven aspects of our domestic and foreign policies? In short, our myths about World War II have formed a rationale to deconstruct our countries and to tear down our societies, and ultimately to undermine our race. Now, there were some interesting points made in feedback to my first program that I would like to address in the second half of tonight's show. I will be dovetailing some of my responses to those interesting points with references to some sources such as Patrick J. Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. In the first half, what I would like to do is deepen the points made in the second half of my first program. So tonight's installment is properly the second part of a series that began with my first program. And if there's sufficient feedback to this program and interest in the material, it might form the basis of an extended series. Now, probably one of the best summaries of Adolf Hitler's foreign policies is to be found in Patrick J. Buchanan's book that I mentioned, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War: How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. In particular, the chapter entitled Hitler's Ambitions gives an interesting and concise summary of Hitler's overall goals. As Buchanan points out, we can discern Hitler's ambitions by looking at several distinct and important resources: his writings in Mein Kampf, his speeches before and after his appointment as Reich Chancellor, his remarks in private, and the structure of the military forces that he prepared in the 1930s, and as they existed after the war was declared by England and France in 1939. Other documents that are relevant to discerning Hitler's ambitions include the Table Talk, excepting, of course, the fake Trevor Roper transcripts of 1945, and also Hitler's own writings in the somewhat controversial second book that he wrote but was never published. There's been some dispute about this latter work because of its discovery and translation by the Jew Gerard L. Weinberg. According to David Irving and a number of other revisionists, however, the book is authentic and was penned by Adolf Hitler. One aspect of the text that lends credence to the authenticity is partly found in the substantial claims and symmetry of positions between what is written therein in the second book and what is found in Mein Kampf, and reflected, in fact, in German foreign policy diplomacy and Hitler's actual foreign policy undertakings after 1933 and well past 1939. Now, there are many issues we can make reference to in discussing these parallels and symmetries, but a decisive and interesting one, given the focus of tonight's and last week's show, make reference to Hitler's intentions toward Britain and his desires with respect to the kind of foreign policy orientation that the British Empire should have adopted after National Socialism would be consolidated in Germany. This is because, in my opinion, what Hitler's intentions were toward the British Empire and to the West in general are foundational to any claim about the ideology or the origins of the Second World War. In Mein Kampf, we see clearly Hitler's foundational views toward the British Empire. While he is transparently aware of the primordiality of Britain's involvement in the First World War and her potential role in a future conflict, he arrives at the conclusion that such a future conflict would be significantly lessened if the fundamental basis of Germany's foreign policy did not contradict the foundations of British foreign policy, which were predicated on primarily naval and commercial concerns. Because under his government, Germany's aims would not involve a disruption of the status quo of Western Europe or the security of Britain's empire. He maintained that he could secure Germany's requirements for security without involving Germany in a full-scale continental war. His search for autarky, directed against the interest of the Soviet regime in the East rather than the democracies of the West, would also provide a point of confluence with the pre-existing anti-Soviet foreign policy of his would-be ally in the British Empire. This was given some semblance of credibility as the 1930s progressed, but would not appear to break down until after 1938, as I argue later. I will also claim that we have to keep this positive orientation toward the British Empire in mind, not because an alliance between Germany and England was necessarily tenable, but because the mere existence in Hitler's foreign policy drives of this kind of orientation is completely antagonistic to the Good War myth. And it is the Good War myth that lies at the heart of Jewish deconstruction of the West. In his second book, and successive steps, in chapter 13, The Possible Goals, Hitler explores four options. One, dispensing with the fundamental foreign policy goal altogether. Two, stabilizing Germany as a principally economic power and spurning a search for living space. Three, a restoration of its frontiers prior to the outbreak of the Great War in 1914. And lastly, a foreign policy predicated primarily on the basis of the acquisition of needed living space for German autarky and security. Hitler rejects the first possibility on a variety of important philosophical grounds. He states in his second book, "So, just as in everyday life a person with a clear-cut goal, which he strives to reach under all circumstances, will always be superior to others who are aimless, it is the same in the life of the nation as well. Above all, though, this is certainly not to say that a state without political objectives will be in a position to avoid the dangers that having such a one could perhaps bring. Because although, yes, he seems relieved from the active participation as a result of his own political aimlessness, he can in his own passivity easily become the victim of the political goals of others. Because the actions of a state are not determined by his will alone, but also by that of others, but with the initiative, while in the other it is forced upon it. Not wanting a war because one has a peaceful disposition certainly does not necessarily mean also being able to avoid it. And certainly, wanting to avoid a war at any cost does not necessarily mean saving life from death. That's from page 156 of this translation of the second book by Weinberg. He also states that, in addition, people that are unable to reach a clear decision about their own future, and accordingly would rather not take part in the game of world development, are viewed by all the players as spoil sports and are constantly hated. Yes, then it can even happen that the aimlessness of individual political actions, based on the overall foreign policy aimlessness, is, on the contrary, viewed as a very clever, non-transparent game, and is responded to accordingly. This was one of the misfortunes that befell us in the pre-war period. The more non-transparent, because incomprehensible, the political decisions of the German government were at the time, the more suspicious they seemed, and the more particularly dangerous ideas were scented behind even in the dumbest of steps. Hitler rejects the second on the basis that it will inevitably lead to economic rivalry with England, and he rejects the third as impossible from the national standpoint. In his words, unsatisfactory from the military standpoint and insane from the standpoint of consequences. Germany thus faces the entire previous coalition of victors as a cohesive front of adversaries in the future as well. Hitler therefore resolves on a far-sighted policy, as he puts it, of acquiring needed living space. He states on pages 158 to 159 of the second book, Germany decides its future goal to adopt a clear, far-sighted policy of space. It thus turns away from all international and industrial and international trade policy attempts and instead concentrates all of its strengths on marking out a way of life for our people through the allocation of adequate living space, Lebensraum, for the next 100 years. Because this space can only lie in the east, the obligation of a naval power takes back seat. Germany again attempts to fight for its interest by forming a decisive power on land. This corresponds equally to the highest national and ethnic requirements. It also presumes a great military power for resources for its implementation, but does not necessarily bring Germany into conflict with all the Western European great powers. France will certainly remain Germany's enemy here as well, but the nature of such a foreign policy goal does not give a reason for England, and especially Italy, to maintain the enmity of the First Great War. So in addition to his views, Hitler discusses in his writings, there are, as Patrick Buchanan points out in this book, aspects of the conduct of German military policy that are further testimony to Hitler's intentions toward the West in general and the British in particular. For example, after entering into the Anglo-German Naval Agreement in 1935, which permitted Germany to build up a sea fleet equivalent to 30% of that of the British, Hitler actually declined to do so. If Hitler had intended to launch an expansive war against the British Empire and against America, it certainly should have been reflected in his naval policies after 1933, and they were not. In 1939, when Britain declared war on Germany, Germany was simply not prepared for a naval confrontation with the British and with America. Even Hitler's fortification of the West Wall, which involved massive financial expenditures and investments in manpower, was designed primarily to deflect an attack from France, and is evidence not only of the land orientation of Hitler's foreign policy, but his principal eastern orientation. Furthermore, even the conflict between Germany and Poland, which the standard good war narrative renders as inevitable, was not initially desired by Hitler. What Hitler had sought was a return of Danzig, an autobahn and a railway link between Germany and East Prussia, and an alliance with Poland directed against the Soviet Union. It was the British war guarantee to Poland that rendered any further positive Polish diplomacy toward Germany unnecessary, and thereby rendered a German-Polish conflict more likely. Without the war guarantee, it is possible that Poland might have agreed to a reasonable return of German peoples and lands and restructured its foreign policy against the Soviet Union, which was a common threat to all of Europe. Buchanan argues that this is precisely what should have animated British foreign policy. And from our racial standpoint today, it is the clearest historical course that could have been taken in our collective interest. In Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, Buchanan writes that on March 31st, 1939, came the deliverance for the Soviet Union. Britain and France declared that they would fight for Poland, the buffer state between Russia and Germany. British Tories had become the guarantors of Bolshevism. Moscow had been given free what Stalin would have paid a Tsar's ransom for. Later, Buchanan writes that British and French emissaries soon arrived to offer Stalin an alliance. Typhoid Mary, that is Soviet Russia, was suddenly the most courted lady in Europe. But without a commitment of his own, Stalin had already the benefit of an alliance with Britain. The Polish war guarantee, given by Britain, wrote Henderson, relieved Russia of all fear of German aggression against herself, and instead of being obliged any longer to consider her own safety, she could now afford to think only of her own personal advantage. That's from page 300 of Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. Later, Buchanan writes, had Britain never given the war guarantee, the Soviet Union would almost surely have borne the brunt of the blow that fell on France. The Red Army, ravaged by Stalin's purges and senior officers, might have collapsed. Bolshevism might have been crushed. Communism might have perished in 1940. Instead of living on for 40 years and murdering tens of millions more in Russia, China, Korea, Vietnam, and Cuba. A Hitler-Stalin war might have been the only war in Europe in 1940. Tens of millions might never have died terrible deaths in the greatest war of all history. And that's from page 301 of Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. This claim by Buchanan is far more credible than it appears on the surface, or has been given credence by some historians. The assumption involves a military confrontation between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1940, minus a war in the West between the Western democracies and Germany, and almost a full year prior to the actual invasion of the Soviet Union that ensued in June 1941. From 1939 to 1941, the Soviet Union had doubled its number of troops, doubled its guns and mortars, and tripled its aircraft. Had a conflict emerged between Germany and the Soviet Union in early 1940, Germany would have dealt with a militarily less defensible Soviet Union, and one that, without the implicit disclosure of an ally in England and America, would have lacked the benefit of lend-lease aid, which in historical reality was decisive in the Soviet victory against Germany. The Soviet Union, in fact, used the 2 years after the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty to prepare for what it knew would be an eventual confrontation with Germany. However, unlike what Buchanan claims, collusion with the Soviet Union to any end by Germany was not the result of some fundamentally identical moral indexes operating in Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, but practical German responses to a war guarantee that Britain had handed to a Polish military dictatorship that had refused to negotiate in reasonable terms with Germany over Danzig, the corridor, and German minorities within Poland. So the Second World War ensued. What began as a localized conflict between Germany and Poland was expanded by Britain and France into a continental one, and was eventually in turn expanded into a global conflict by the intervention of America and its variety of illegal acts in naval and economic terms, and by 1941 had engulfed most of the major nations of the earth. And the second half of this program, I'm going to talk about some aspects of the practicality of Adolf Hitler's goals toward the West. Some criticism has emerged with respect to these points that were made in the first program. I'd like to tackle a few of these. So I hope you'll stick around and join me in the second half, and I'll have some other points to make as well, including Adolf Hitler's awareness of the extensive Jewish influence in British finance in spite of his own desire for an ethnically based alliance between the Germans and the English. So stick around, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. welcome back to An Hour by the Window. We're talking about Adolf Hitler's fundamental foreign policy objectives, and to some extent in the second half, their feasibility, and the basis of Hitler's perceptions that some of these alliances and foreign policy goals that he desired were attainable. Now, Hitler in Mein Kampf argues that the premise for the linking national destinies of nations is never based on mutual respect, let alone affection, but on the prospect of expediency for both contracting parties. While he is not naive about the full prospects of an entente or an alliance with England, he clearly sees a pragmatic basis in a future collusion between German and English goals. He states that while England desires no Germany as a world power, France wishes no power at all called Germany. Quite an essential difference, after all. Today we are not fighting for a position as a world power. Today we must struggle for the existence of our fatherland, for the unity of our nation, and the daily bread of our children. Therefore, Hitler says, if we look about us for European allies from this standpoint, there remain only two states, England and Italy. In other words, Hitler is arguing that while France colludes for a permanently weakened Germany, inferior on the continent if non-existent, England at least has striven to ensure that Germany has not threatened the world position, principally of its naval and commercial interests. In yet other terms, as I tried arguing in the first program last week, Hitler saw Germany's world power as rooted in soil and continental in scope. Such a position would be unthreatening to British interests, and that in itself was desirable because the English themselves, to Hitler, were a superior race of people, ethno-linguistically Germanic, and fundamentally opposed to the extension of Bolshevism to the continent. This last facet is an important element in Hitler's pragmatism, because opposition to the internal and external threat of organized Marxism was a principal element of National Socialist domestic and foreign policy, a policy that brought it into direct accord with the actual interests, the authentic interest of the British government. The Soviet Union, in its own propaganda, projected itself as the principal enemy of colonialism, a fact fully attested by the post-war actual foreign policy of the Soviet state, which, in the decades following the war, strove to undermine Europe's position in the world. But neither was Hitler naive about the influence of world Jewry and the West, in general, or in the British government in particular, and the potential influence it might have to captivate the interest of the British Empire or America in making war or initiating a conflict with Germany. In Mein Kampf, he states that Jewish dissonance with actual English interest is, as he puts it, nowhere better shown than in their different position on the questions of British foreign policy. Jewish finance in opposition to the interest of the British state welfare does not only extend to complete economic annihilation of Germany, but also to a complete political enslavement. And so the Jew today is the great agitator, he puts it later, for the complete destruction of Germany. Wherever in the world we read of attacks against Germany, Jews are their fabricators, just as in peacetime and during the First World War, inserting that because obviously he's just making a reference to the Great War, the press of the Jewish Stock Exchange and Marxists systematically stirred up hatred against Germany until state after state abandoned neutrality and, renouncing the true interest of their peoples, entered the service of the World War Coalition. The influence of Jews on British economic conduct was therefore not at all alien to Hitler. It was equally apparent to him that Jews were principal conduits and agents in British economic life, just as they had been significant agents in the Bolshevik regime that precipitated the so-called Russian Revolution and established the Soviet state in 1922. In fact, further on in Mein Kampf, Hitler asks, can the forces of traditional British statesmanship break the devastating Jewish influence or not? He then appeals to the model of fascist Italy, which appeared to him to provide a clear model of state that had organized itself along the authentic interest of its own people, much to the exclusion of a concentration of Jewish economic influence. Things, Hitler states, are much more difficult in England. In this country of the freest democracy, the Jew exerts an almost unlimited dictatorship indirectly through public opinion. And yet, there are an incessant struggle is taking place between the advocates of British state interests and the proponents of a Jewish world dictatorship. So there's a mirror in Hitler's analysis of the Jewish element in the British state and its economic life, and that of post-war America, which had already suffocated under Jewish economic influence and now witnessed a further Jewification in domestic and foreign policy, principally as the result of the mythologizing of the war that began prior to America's involvement. Fundamentally, what Hitler is evidencing here is his belief, not without foundation, that there were policymakers in the British government that were willing to accommodate many of National Socialism's aims. It was not so much an underestimation of the scope of Jewish influence as simply the practical reality of foreign policy conduct with Britain, with Britain's views toward Germany after the First World War, which did not become antagonistic toward Germany until after 1938 in full form. From 1933, when Hitler became Reich Chancellor, through 1935, when the Anglo-German naval agreement was signed, and on through 1938, it appeared to Hitler that the British Empire was attempting to accommodate his basic foreign policy goals without any kind of overt military confrontation. It was the Soviet state itself in which Hitler saw the most concrete external threat to Germany. Reacting progressively against Western diplomacy in the 1930s, it became increasingly apparent to him that the British government would not risk war to hinder German aims in Eastern Europe or obstruct its foreign policy toward the Soviet Union. And the fact of the policy of so-called appeasement is a testimony to the validity of the basis of this view to an extent. In fact, the Soviet-German non-aggression treaty and subsequent treaty of friendship was a reversal of his long-standing views of the Soviet Union, and was designed, or were designed, principally as a response to the British war guarantee to Poland that was delivered in March 1939. That stymied further German-Polish negotiations. There were too many instances where the West had not delivered military resistance to Hitler's actions for him to formulate the basis of a credible, dire threat from Britain, France, or America. For example, the West rejected an offer from Poland's Pilsudski in 1933 to jointly militarily intervene in Germany to destroy National Socialism in its infancy. France's lack of reaction to Hitler's reoccupation of the Rhineland in 1936, or Britain's significant, though non-military, reaction to the dismantling of the pro-Soviet Czechoslovak rump state in early 1939. In fact, these are so commonly and regularly touted as junctures where the West could decisively have dealt with Germany. But the underlying premise of this program is that the assumption of a necessarily inevitable reaction in military form culminating in a war to Hitler's foreign policy is precisely what underlies the good war myth and has given fuel to so many policies that have undermined us in racial terms. While there can be, and certainly is, criticism of Hitler's perspective on the British Empire, his perspective of the prospect for reform to the extent that the British government might see it unnecessary to follow Jewish patterns of foreign policy, we should bear in mind that what we're dealing with in this specific case are narratives that provide a false view of his perspectives on the West, and that these narratives are what have been used to undermine us in racial terms. Criticism of Hitler's perspective on the British Empire is certainly welcome from an historical vantage, however, because it inevitably invites his real intentions. And that's relevant to our political context, which were in the last analysis not to undermine it and the West. This, in fact, is the contrary claim made by those who have exploited myths about World War II, just as it was advanced by propagandists in the West just to induce Britain into an unnecessary war with Germany. In Patrick J. Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, this is to some degree the argument that is advanced. Buchanan argues that everywhere we can see clearly that the West is fading away, and that as a share of the world's population, people of European descent have been shrinking for three generations. This is about as racially explicit as Buchanan gets, given that he's advancing the views of a racially aware paleoconservative, not that of a racial nationalist. But it is precisely the racial angle that has to be fully developed in any ideology or account of the impact of the Good War myth and its narrative on our institutions, on us as a race, because that is the most concrete dimension and fundamental element of our decline. Strip away institutions and cultures, and you are left with concrete groups of people that can bear and transmit those institutions and cultures. People can graft democratic institutions and cultural systems onto themselves, and that is precisely what is happening as our countries obfuscate a reality of our own biological displacement. Our task is to arrest our decline, and partly in order to do that, we have to come to terms with realities about the past that are not simply intellectually objectionable to our enemies, but are the precise bases of assumptions that have been used to foment the decline of whites as a race, and of all people of European descent. So, I hope that you've enjoyed this show of An Hour by the Window, and that it's given you some food for thought, that you will engage me in some discussion in the comment section of the show page, and ideally join me again next week for my next show. We do appreciate your support of the White Network. Thank you, and have a good night.